This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Friday today. It is episode 294, I think. And this may be a little shorter today unless I sit in my garage and talk, which I am wont to do. Hear that? I took my car, my good little old car that has 162,000 miles on it. I took my good little old car to the mechanic. The mechanic checked it all out. He said, "Everything looks good." It's like, yes. He did say that there was a boot. There was a boot on the front that sometimes when they start getting old, they make that kind of weird squeaking sound. So we're just going with that. That's going to be the plan. Boot makes the squeaking sound. This may be a little shorter today. It is Friday as opposed to Thursday, and I'm not actually starting out from my major client because we replaced our well this week. Our well pump this week, and as part of that, I have a new filter, whole house filter, to go in downstairs, and so I needed to stop at Lowe's, and the only reason I'm in town anyways on a Friday is because I actually had a meeting at my major client today where we were talking about status and progress and where we are and what the plans are and what we're trying to get set up and yada, 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 yada. So all that stuff was going on. And in addition to that, my wife is working on her children's musical presentation, and so she needed the recorder to record some of her kids, since it does such a nice job. And so she had it yesterday, which is the reason I didn't do my podcast yesterday. Anyways, everything else is puttering along. The book is coming along. I'm at 87,000 words? Somewhere in there. I can't remember. It's going along fine. Still kind of in an action section, so it writes out, you know, pretty easily. I did hit one section that slowed me down a little bit because it was actually a near-death experience, and so had to kind of read up a little bit on near-death experiences and then try to at least do some kind of spin that was a little bit different on it. Got that taken care of. And I'm at that point in the book where I'm thinking, when I go back and read this through for the first time, I sure hope it's okay. Because there's always that, you know, you get in the middle of scene after scene after scene, and it's a little bit difficult sometimes. You lose focus on the overall picture. But I think we're okay. Don't know until you actually read it. But I think we're okay. So now I just gotta land it well. Whatever that means. Because I thought I landed the last one well, and a lot of the beta readers agreed with me. But I had some beta readers who didn't think I landed it well. They wanted more big action on the very end, which I intentionally didn't do that. Because it's 24 books, you gotta have some place to build. But there's plenty of action in the middle and through the book. So it'll be interesting. This is very, very, very interesting. And I'm taking a slightly different way home, which is why the roads sound a little different today, if anyone's listening. So anyways, that's good. House is good. We're getting a new roof put on our house, so we got to go pick out shingles. Grandkids are good. Actually went to a breakfast at my granddaughter's preschool last Friday, so that was fun. Got a chance to sit around and talk with dads. Actually, we just talked among ourselves, our family, but we all kind of like that. Talked to my son-in-law for a while, and my granddaughter's mom's husband, and granddaughter's mom's husband, so grandpa on the other side, so we had a real nice time. And big and exciting? I came across a TED Talk several weeks ago, and I marked it because the guy had some interesting things to say. And so I thought, oh, I should talk about this. And I thought he had some interesting perspectives. And it was on privacy and why privacy matters. And I should say as a precursor that this is one of the journalists who had worked with Edward Snowden. And so that kind of gives him an interesting perspective on privacy. We just passed the tower, I just passed the tower. I don't usually go home this way. Passed the tower, that is the 911 emergency tower that has a bunch of other equipment on it. Plus, it has the small little dish that actually connects my house to the internet. I always like to pause and say a grateful thank you to that tower because on my property, I beam over to my tower, and then on my tower, there's a thing that beams over to this tower over here, and then that gets down into fiber, and it gets me to the internet. So yay to that tower. Thank you very much for internet. Anyways, privacy. And so he gave a TED Talk on privacy. I thought what he had to say was very interesting. He started out his talk by discussing the specific genre on YouTube that is devoted to an experience which everyone, he said, I think in this room has had. He said, you're an individual who you think you're alone, and so you engage in some behavior, wildly singing, gyrating, dancing, some mild sexual activity, only to discover that in fact they are not alone, that there is a person watching and lurking, and the discovery immediately causes them to cease what they were doing in horror. The sense of shame and humiliation is palpable on their faces. It is the sense of, this is something I'm willing to do only if no one else is watching. Which is a really interesting thing, given if what I believe about the nature of the world is true, given if what the Bible tells about us about the nature of the world is true. Coming up, big burp. Because there's a turn lane there, but the turn lane's really short, so you just might as well drive over the thing that's supposed to tell you not to drive over stuff. Anyways, so this is the experience where you think you're alone, you're not alone. And he said for 16 months now, he's been working on a specific question of why does privacy matter? A question that has arisen in the contents of a global debate that was enabled by the revelations of Edward Snowden, that the United States and its partners, okay, unbeknownst to the entire world, converted the internet into one giant surveillance machine. So he said, you know, people have reacted to this in a bunch of different ways. He said, there's some people who said, you know, well, what's the big deal? You know, only people in bad acts have a reason to hide or carry. He said, you know, they've got this worldview that there's good people and then there's bad people. And bad people are those who plot terrorist attacks and engage in violent criminality. And they have a reason to want to hide what they're doing. But the good people, we just go to work, come home, raise our children, watch television. And we don't really care, you know, if people see what we do. And he said, what they're really saying is, I thought this was interesting, what they're really saying is, quote, this is his quoting of what he thinks they're saying, quote, I have agreed to make myself such a harmless and unthreatening and uninteresting person that I actually don't fear having the government know what I'm doing. Now, he said that's kind of the basis. And he said the big technology companies will sort of parrot this, where Eric Schmidt, whom I've talked about in the past, whom everybody thinks is the oracle that we should go, you know, who sometimes says things that are not oracle worthy. So his response, being the head of the company, who of course has contributed to the invasion of privacy for hundreds of millions of people around the world, he said, well, there's the mail person trying to get their mail in, and I've got to cross a line and I can't see anyone who's coming, but we're good. Okay. He said, if you're doing something you don't want other people to know, well, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. Okay, well, that sounds good on the surface, but the author of this talk, his name was Glenn Greenwald. He went on to say that the people who say that, they don't really believe it. So they don't actually believe that if you're doing only good things, you don't care about who knows about it. Because all of these people put passwords on their privacy, on their mail, all that kind of thing. You know, they put locks on their bedroom and bathroom doors. They all do things to stop people from knowing about what they're doing privately. They said, in fact, this very same Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, ordered his employees at Google to cease speaking with the online internet magazine CNET after CNET published an article full of personal private information about him, which it obtained exclusively through Google searches and other Google products. So Eric Schmidt, who's supposed to be one of the oracles of our world, you know, he says, well, if you're doing things you don't want people about to do, then you shouldn't do it. Okay, so then CNET turns around and they do an article on Eric Schmidt based on the internet, on the information they found on the internet using Google searches, and he gets upset. So there's a disconnect here somewhere, you know? There's a disconnect. Because it's like, I want to justify the fact that my company's doing this, and so this is the way I smugly justify it, but then when those same tools are used against me, I don't like it. Yeah, there you go. The author of the talk went on to talk about Mark Zuckerberg, who in a famous interview in 2010... pronounced that privacy is no longer a social norm. Why? Because, of course, that would support his company. He says later, last year, though, Mark Zuckerberg and his new wife purchased not only their own house, but also all four adjacent houses in Palo Alto for a total of $30 million in order to ensure that they enjoyed a zone of privacy that prevented people from monitoring what they do in their personal lives. So people say one thing, but then they do something else. And the author also of this talk had a really great example. This was fabulous. He said, I have people come up to me all the time and say, I don't really worry about invasions of privacy because I don't have anything to hide. And he said, I always say the same thing to them. I get out my pen, write down my email address, and I say, here's my email address. What I want you to do when you get home is email me the passwords to all of your email accounts, and not just the nice, respectable work one in your name, but all of them, because I want to be able to just troll through everything you're doing online, read what I want, and publish whatever I find. After all, if you're not a bad person, you're doing nothing wrong, and you should have nothing to hide. He said, not surprisingly, no one has ever taken him up on that offer. He said, there's all kinds of things that we're willing to tell our physician or our lawyer or a psychologist or our spouse that we don't necessarily want the world to know about. Um, said people can very easily in words claim that they don't value their property, but their actions negate the authenticity of that belief. And he said, honestly, there's a reason that privacy is craved. The reason is that when we're in a state where we can be monitored, where we can be watched, our behavior changes dramatically. The range of behavioral options that we consider when we think about being watched severely reduces. And he said there's lots and lots and lots of studies about this. I actually mentioned in one of my TED Talks that I had done on Darren Brown. I lost his last name there for a second. One of the talks that I've done did on Darren Brown, talking about spirituality and belief in ghosts and stuff. He actually had a bunch of people who were atheists. He had one group and then another control group, and individually they were put into this room with a game where they took a little loop of wire and went around another way. And every time they hit the loop of wire with the other piece of wire, it would go, eh, and they were supposed to add up how many times they hit that and report on how many times they hit it. So one group, they just told them the game, left them alone individually, and then got their answers and compared them to the videotape that they had taken of them. The other group, they had put a chair in the room, and they had told them, oh yeah, that chair, that's just goofy. That's just going to be on a show called Ghost Antiques, and they're just storing it here, never mind. What was interesting is that the people with these are atheists, okay? Backing into my garage. That the people who performed the little game in the room with the chair, atheists who did not believe in the supernatural, just the idea that there was a chair in the room that a ghost might be sitting in, just that idea kept them honest. And they reported accurately how many times, or at least much more close to accurately, how many times they hit the wires as they were going around. Whereas the other group of atheists, they like greatly reduced their numbers because they were like, oh, that one didn't count. Oh, I didn't mean to do that. That didn't count. And it was et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He said, this idea that people will behave like you want them to behave, I'm going to roll up my window so there's not so much echo. This idea that people will behave as you want them to behave if they think someone's watching them has been exploited for a long time. And he said, in the industrial age, where for the first time institutions had become so large and centralized that they were no longer able to monitor and therefore control each of their members, there was a solution that was designed that was originally implemented for prisons that this one guy called the Panopticon, which I love that name, the Panopticon. I'm going to use that somewhere. The Panopticon, it was this enormous tower where at any moment the guards could watch anyone in the prison, but the windows were darkened so you couldn't actually tell who was watching what when. And just the fact of that brought the prisoners into better compliance. The thing about it is the guy who invented that, he was just like, well, we could use this everywhere. And it is true that it works. I mean, there's the old story about the trust system snacks, where there's just snacks and, you know, in an office and you're supposed to put money in when you get a snack out. And if you put a giant eyeball, just a picture of a giant eyeball up there, you actually make more money than if the eyeball's gone because people are coming in and pilfering. I mean, this is just kind of human nature. And at one point, you know, he even talks about how the Abrahamic tradition of a God that, you know, watches over everyone and sees everything, that obviously that was just invented to try to keep people in line. And he talks about, he said, the first thing that people think about is 1984 when we start talking about this. But he says there is an actual fundamental misapprehension of the warnings that Orwell issued in 1984. The warning that he was issuing was about a surveillance state, not that monitored everybody at all times, but where people were aware that they could be monitored at any given moment. Here's how Orwell's narrator, Winston Smith, described the surveillance system that they faced. There was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment, he went on to say. At any rate, they could plug in your wire whenever they wanted to. You had to live from a habit that became instinct in the assumption that every sound you made was overheard, except in darkness, every movement was scrutinized. And this guy's point is that that type of surveillance then breeds conformity and obedience and submission. And he thinks that that is a fundamental loss to human freedom. He said, the last point I want to observe about this mindset, the idea where only people who are doing something wrong have things to hide and therefore reason to crave about privacy, is that it entrenches two destructive messages, two destructive lessons. The first of which is that only the people who care about privacy, the only people who care about privacy are the bad people. And this is the conclusion that we have all kinds of reasons for avoiding, the most important of which is somebody doing something bad things, you probably mean like a terrorist attack, blah, blah, blah. A much narrower conception of what people who wield power mean when they say doing bad things. For them, doing bad things typically means doing something that exposes meaningful challenge to the exercise of your own power. Now, okay, so really what this comes down to for me in this matrix is whenever you're building a structure, of course, the first thing you start to become concerned about is how can I keep this structure in place? How can I preserve this structure? And so then you want to start policing everybody in the structure to make sure that they're not a threat to the structure or they're doing things that are a threat to the structure. And then all sorts of things start getting ratcheted down that don't have anything to do with the joy and wonder of life and or anything to do potentially with the preservation of the structure. It might have something to do with it. And then you start getting into things like, well, maybe that by itself might not have anything to do with harming the structure of this entity. But what if people on the outside misinterpret what you're doing? And this type of thing is rife within religious organizations. You know, well, if you do that and someone sees that and they happen to be more conservative, then they might get mad and they might cause a stink and then that might harm the organization. You know, it's just all of a sudden all the wondrous things that are available in the world and all the wondrous things that we can explore and learn, we start, no, you can't do that. No, because someone might be offended by that. No, you can't, you know. And so you end up with a life that is just. And he goes back to that bargain he talked about in the beginning, that if you're willing to render yourself sufficiently harmless, sufficiently unthreatening to those who wield political powers, then and only then can you be free of the dangers of surveillance. It is only those who are dissidents who challenge power have something to worry about. He said, there are all kinds of reasons that we should want to avoid this lesson as well. You may be a person who right now doesn't want to engage in that behavior, but at some point in the future, you might. And even if you're somebody that decides you never want to, the fact is there are other people who are willing to and able to resist and be adversarial to those in power, dissidents and journalists and activists and a whole range of others, like Edward Snowden. And it's something that brings us all collective good and we should want to preserve. Honestly, I mean, at this point, now that we've been in the Snowden revelations for a while, I've heard the intelligence communities talking about how the fact that, oh, it was terrible what happened to us and blah, 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 blah. But I don't really see the effect of it. You know, the sky has not fallen. So I personally, at this point, think that what Edward Snowden did was a tremendously brave thing to do. And if laws were actually being broken, Well, we have laws for a reason, not to break them and hide them because of national security, which is a whole issue that I'm going to get into in Windfall. That's going to be fun. So I think this guy, well, in his conclusions, he says equally critical is that measure of how a free society is not how it treats its good, obedient, compliant citizens, but how it treats its dissidents and those who resist orthodoxy, which I completely agree with that statement. You know, do you require in your city, in your society, that everyone toe the line and step in line, or do you accept people where they are and allow them the freedom and the free will to do things that you wouldn't necessarily approve of? And I think when we look at it from God's perspective, everything I see from God's perspective seems to lean towards the latter. When the Jews moved into Palestine, the only form of government that God actually chose for them was let everyone do what's right in their own eyes. That's free will, up and down, let everyone do free will. And it's very different from living under a king, which is what the Israelites finally asked to do. So he did have an interesting quote in here. He said, but the most important reason that a system of mass surveillance suppresses our own freedoms, but the most important reason is that a system of mass surveillance suppresses our own freedom in all sorts of ways. It renders off limits all sorts of behavioral choices without even our knowing what happened. The renowned social activist Rosa Luxemburg once said, he who does not move does not notice his chains. Great quote. Great quote. Said, we can try and render the chains of mass surveillance invisible or undetectable, but the constraints that it imposes on us do not become any less potent. So that's very interesting. Now then, you know, what's interesting about some of this stuff for me is when you look at it kind of in a larger context of we have been told all our lives in our religious experience that God is watching us. But the truth of the matter is that it's, you know, there was that song, you're, God is watching us from a distance. And I always used to laugh when I heard that song because it was like, okay, well, if God is watching us from a distance, then everything must be okay because he can't really see anything from that far away because, according to the song, from a distance, everything looks great. So, hey, we're good with God because he can't really see how messed up we are. But in fact, if we are to believe what the scripture says about God's relationship to us, specifically Jesus Christ's relationship, it's that he is not watching us from a distance, that he is an integral part of our world, that in fact all things consist by him, that he holds everything together, that he is intimately connected with everything that's going on. And so basically every thought that we have, every step that we take, everything that we do is seen by him. Now we like to ignore that, but he is there. And what we need to learn about him is he knows us better than we know ourselves. And this idea that we need to be afraid of him because he knows all about us was only cooked up by people who are trying to get individuals to fall in line and ascribe to a certain structure. Now, it is true that in the Old Testament, God has all kinds of language that is fear-inspired. But I would submit that that was the best he could possibly do with the cultural environment that existed at that time. And that the reason that we see a shift to a message of love with the appearance of Jesus is that the time had come to move humanity to the next step in their relationship with God. That's a whole other huge discussion. And so I think a lot of the idea of God being able to see everything and understand everything we're doing, the only real problem that comes out of that is that when it is exploited by structures trying to tell us that God has a big stick and he's going to club us over the head, or it's when our own flesh tries to exploit that into stopping us from doing something temporarily. so that it can grind on us about how much we want to do that. No, you can't do that with God. God's the one who doesn't want you to do that. To create within us this anger and this resentment of God so that it can eventually exploit that and flip that around and cause us to go off the deep end. But, you know, a long time ago, I decided that God knows who I am. He sees all the little quirky parts of my personality that no one but my wife sees. And so I really don't have a problem if he sees all those things because he knows who I am. He knows my heart. And if there are a bunch of little quirky things that are in my personality, things that I like that are just weird and odd, I understand enough about people that obviously that's not stuff I'm going to reveal to just anybody. But I have a wonderful wife that, you know, is willing to hear about them. And I have a God who already knows about all of them and is not waiting to beat me over to the head because I don't happen to conform in certain areas to societal proclaimed standards. And I'll just leave that there because I'm sure now everybody's like, oh, what is it? What is it? It doesn't matter what it is. What really matters in all of that is I have over the years come to a place of comfort where it's just fun for me, even though it would sort of set some people's head to the side and might even spin their heads around if they knew. But I just smile because I know who I am and I know who my God is. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.